Welcome to the Newsbusters podcast with the executive editor of Newsbusters, your host, Tim Graham.
Hello and welcome. I hope you have got your Mother's Day present planned. Can't say I did just yet. We'll get there. Mother's Day always seems to be more important than Father's Day, if I may complain for just a minute. But I do make my family like, okay, we're going to go somewhere weird out to eat, and then maybe we'll all watch a cartoon movie, an animated movie. That would be my way of punishing them all. You have to do what I want today. Anyway, the first subject today is protesting and reporting. The Washington Post issued a memo on Monday to address the actions of their news staff in June. What's upcoming? Well, Gay Pride Month for one, Juneteenth celebrations for another. So they put out a memo that said something like this. We want to make clear that newsroom employees may participate in celebratory parades or festivals that are not partisan or political. For example, newsroom staff may attend Pride, capital P, or Juneteenth celebrations, July 4th parades, heritage festivals, and other such non-political gatherings. Then they added, protests, demonstrations, and partisan activities are another matter. We intend no relaxation of our long-standing expectation that newsroom employees refrain from such expressions of public advocacy. As a rule, we are witnesses and observers in the public square, not participants or activists. Really? And then it continues. Context matters. It would be fine to participate in a celebration at BLM Plaza in D.C., but not a protest there, or attend a pride gathering, but not a demonstration at the Supreme Court. This memo is designed as a warning, probably, about what you shouldn't do, but it's also sort of a concession. I have 2 points when I read through this. One, define non-political events. Juneteenth, for example, is not easily defined as a non-political event. Juneteenth.com says that this holiday is a time to, quote, challenge coworkers to present African-American facts, debunk myths and stereotypes, and a time to discuss company diversity initiatives and ensure employees that race and gender will never be barriers to their progress within the company. That sounds political to me. Inclusion and diversity. There's a politics in it. There's an identity politics in it. Obviously, if you're having a gay pride march, we're going to guess that there's going to be a bunch of Democratic politicians there looking for votes. Juneteenth celebrations is something where you're going to, if you have a public event, you're going to expect Democratic politicians to show up at an event like that. So to me, that's not necessarily a non-political gathering. Gay pride is in part political, but what they're trying to say is they don't want to deny someone's identity with a capital I. The memo goes on. A newsroom employee would not hold a protest sign at a parade or wear a hat supporting or opposing a political candidate or legislative policy, but might wear a rainbow cap, wave an American flag, or wear a t-shirt celebrating their identity. They say here details matter. A shirt with the flag of the District of Columbia is fine. One supporting statehood would not be. This to me seems a little bit like nitpicking. Because these are, you know, at some point this whole thing blurs. I mean, let's just say they mention waving an American flag. Are we really going to catch Washington Post reporters waving an American flag? I mean, maybe they might put one outside their house. But in fact, on the job, reporters don't like wearing flag pins. They don't want to participate in the Pledge of Allegiance if it's recited at the White House or other venues. I mean, when I was in the White House press corps, it was very noticeable when I was standing among the reporters, as I was one, I was the oddball who would just recite the Pledge of Allegiance. To me, that's a long-standing thing. It brings me back to seeing the Pledge of Allegiance in the classroom, seeing the Pledge of Allegiance at Boy Scout meetings. It should be non-controversial to say the Pledge of Allegiance. But in this case, liberal reporters would say, well, I can't say the Pledge of Allegiance. I can't wave a flag. That would suggest I have some sort of bias in favor of America. I mean, an important part of my identity is being a Catholic. And I would understand a boss saying, well, you can't go to the March for Life. That's the anti-abortion rally, which really, if you go to it, seems like quite a Catholic event. But I could wear a Pope Benedict T-shirt. Well, to many, this can define ideology. You know, we've discussed recently the Washington Post hostility to those so-called right-wing bishops who are questioning how devout a Catholic Biden is. But inside the Washington Post, someone with my religious worldview would probably not be hireable. They would probably use terms like, yeah, we don't think you're a good fit for the company. Conservatives in general, I mean, I came to town in 1986. Do you think that I dropped off my resume at the Washington Post? I mean, it's a prestigious place to work. I just didn't think I'd have a chance. I mean, there was the whole ideology thing, and then there was the whole political science and mass comm degree from Bemidji State University. Probably not that impressive when you're competing with kids from Harvard. But we all understand what the Washington Post is. It's a liberal Democrat entity. And so they're just trying to say, let's not be out there, you know, where we can be photographed holding a protest sign, wearing a Biden hat. I mean, that's sensible because we certainly would make an issue out of it if we saw that. But then there's the second point. If the Post is this concerned about the appearance of taking one side, why aren't they actually doing that every day in the actual stories in the newspaper? Why aren't they more concerned about their reporters flagrantly editorializing on Twitter? I mean, it's quite obvious to anybody who just reads the front page of the paper a lot of times where they're coming from. You know, their reporting on Trump was all, and today, the president blatantly lied and endangered America. I mean, their reporting, their so-called news reporting, was quite obviously hostile, just where now it's the opposite. It's sort of like, suddenly, President Biden is, you know, leading a rational crusade against the coronavirus. Their headlines show bias, their photographs show bias. Everything that they're doing shows bias in the news section. So you would just say, you know, it's one thing to tell people which T-shirt they can wear on the weekend. Why don't you focus in a little bit more on what you're actually putting in the paper? And the irony of this is that newspapers like The Post, they will make a point of putting the black reporter on the race story. They will make sure they put the gay reporter on the LGBT story. In this case, the notion of a conflict of interest is just nixed in favor of the notion that, well, one, this is the story that the black reporter or the gay reporter wants to cover, and it's the story that they'll have a greater knowledge and sensitivity to the particulars. They will be able to get to the sources of this story and project a greater sympathy, so we'll get more openness as they, you know, discuss their mutual grievances. I mean, that's the irony, is I think, again, a reporter with somebody who had my point of view, they'd say, well, we can't put this Catholic guy that likes Pope Benedict, you can't put him on the Catholic story. He can't be trusted with that. But when it comes to something like race, the Washington Post is so eager to take that mantle of black sensitivity is that they made a big deal out of creating an editor who would oversee racial issues, and a staff of reporters underneath the editor for racial issues covering racial issues. So, I mean, to them, the notion of approaching an issue like race objectively would seem insensitive. It's racially insensitive to cover this like blacks and whites both have grievances. We couldn't possibly do that. Next up, we will talk about the state of liberal media fact-checking with our guest Sister Tolja, coming up after this.
MRC-store.com.
Pro-gun, pro-life, pro-God, and pro-America? Welcome to the Pro Shop.
MRC-store.com.
T-shirts, hoodies, goodies, and much more.
MRC-store.com.
The only store that always offers conservatives more.
That's MRC-store.com.
Log on, log in, and help the Media Research Center while shopping for great gear today.
MRC-store.com.
We are back on the Newsbusters podcast with our guest this week, Stacey Matthews, who you may know as Sister Tolja. It's a play on Sister Soldier. We're old enough now. I'm not sure everybody gets that anymore. Stacey writes at Red State and Legal Insurrection and has a column at North State Journal. And in particular, there was an article she did at Red State called CNN's Daniel Dale sounds the final death knell for fact-checking. And I said, that is a good article and a good starting point. Welcome, Stacey.
Good morning, Tim. It is an honor and a pleasure and a privilege to be on with you this morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, maybe we should take a minute to remind the young people who Sister Soldier was. Was it 92 that it was a big thing that Bill Clinton spoke critically of a rapper?
It was the year that he was elected, I believe, and a rapper named Sister Soulja, she made some type of comment. I don't even remember exactly what it was, but she made some type of comment where she was saying, I think she said it was okay, it should be okay for black people to kill white people, and Bill Clinton spoke out forcefully against it, and that was regarded as his Sister Soldier moment.
Exactly.
And some 10 or so years later, I actually picked up the Sister Tolja nickname on a political website forum that I used to go back and forth with a lot of liberals. And I picked up the name there and it just stuck. and that's why I used it in my blog. And interestingly enough, there actually was another Sister Tolja who came on the scene about 2 years after I did, and she was a black militant feminist liberal.
Oh.
And people used to mix us up on Twitter because I didn't always use my picture on online. For a while, I didn't use my picture online, and so people used to get us mixed up. I used to get messages for her, and she would get messages for me. And she actually now is using her real name, and I think she is an MSNBC commentator. I think it's Jamila Lemieux, I think is her name.
Oh, yeah. I've heard the name.
Now,
So Daniel Dale is, like many of the fact checkers at the 100-day mark, is sort of trying to explain how fact checking has changed. And I guess this was a tweet where he said, "This president says some inaccurate stuff. Not ideal, but there's no pretending that this era is remotely similar to the last president's staggering daily avalanche of extreme wrongness," to which you said,
"Using the term inaccurate stuff is ridiculous. You know, you need to call a lie a lie. If President Trump lied, that's what they called it back when he was president. President Biden shouldn't be any different. If he tells a lie, it's not just inaccurate stuff. It's a lie. For example, if I look out at the sky right now and say the sky is green, that's inaccurate, but it's not a lie. If I look outside and say it's raining when it's not, that's a lie. There's a difference, and they need to be calling it down the line like they did with Trump. They need to do the same thing with Biden, or it all falls apart."
Yeah, I think that what you said, that you actually, this was really cool. You were like, Dale doesn't use the word lie once in the piece he did. Lacking context was mentioned. Misleading was used twice. Inaccurate three times. And the operative term was false claims. I mean, this is part of the nature of how slippery the fact-checking business is.
Yes, it is. And Dale is actually given us many previews of how he would have treated he was going to treat Biden had he come into office. I mean, some of the fact checks that he did last year during the presidential debate and the CNN town hall, they were just incredible. How he studiously avoided using the word lie. And he actually, made a claim about Biden last year that he said Biden was actually fact-checking Trump because Biden was using several coherent sentences all at the same time. I mean, this is just insanity. And, as much as we rag on fact-checkers, for being so biased, it is funny in some ways. In other ways, it's not, because we actually need fact checkers, just like we need the media. But when you can't count on them to call it down the line, then everything falls apart. And then that's what brings in people like me and you to come in and correct the record where they won't.
Yeah, we have now, our project, Fact Checking the Fact Checkers. And some of that is just basically saying, actually, your fact check is inaccurate. Or that sort of snap judgment they make where they say, well, that's factually true, but we're going to rate it mostly false, you know?
Right.
That's factually true, but you get three Pinocchios. And it's that sort of slipperiness. And of course, people need to understand how Daniel Dale got this fact checking gig at CNN. Daniel Dale, was sort of notorious on Twitter. He was working in Toronto for the Toronto Star newspaper, and he was sufficiently anti-Trump to be hired by them as their fact checker. So obviously, to some degree, he was hired as a raging anti-Trump activist. So of course he's going to say, well, I've got to be different now. But it's exactly what makes you say, we don't trust CNN, the fact checker, any more than we trust regular CNN. They're all doing the same thing.
Right. I remember you talking about how he was picked for CNN. I remember seeing some of his tweets in my timeline before he ever became a fact checker for CNN. And when I saw that they had announced that he had gotten that gig, I thought, you've got to be kidding me. I mean, it just gets worse at CNN all the time. It's like they're in a bubble there in CNN among all three of the networks. CNN is probably most in the bubble about how toxic what they do is, and that not just with fact checking, but with their regular reporting and with their anchors, that are supposed to be neutral, but they're not. It's just a clown show there, and Daniel Dale is among the worst.
I think that there is a. They know internally what they're doing. They know what they're making. They used to argue about objectivity, and they'd say, well, if our news doesn't seem objective to you, well, we're certainly trying to be objective. I don't think anybody can watch CNN now and think, well, gee, we're trying really hard not to editorialize. I mean, it's quite obvious. And so I think what's interesting is the fact-checking is so particular, and that is they decide what is a fact worth checking and what is a fact not worth checking. And the latest column I did today was about how Joe Biden could be fact-checked on many things, but when he calls the Republicans Jim Crow on steroids, or their voter integrity bills are Jim Crow in the 21st century or Jim Crow on steroids, there's no fact-check of that. That to them, I guess, is sort of an acceptable thing to say.
Right. And because fact checkers say that, then it becomes accepted in the media. I read your column as well. I mean, they'll fact check somebody calling a Democrat a socialist like John Ossoff. They went nuts, when David Perdue called John Ossoff a socialist. But yet, Biden can use this very specific racially loaded language. And he's not the only one. Stacey Abrams, of course, has done the same thing. They can use this specifically loaded racial language that carries heavy, heavy meaning especially for people here in the South, black and white. And they just, like you said, it becomes part of the acceptable terminology, and you just move forward from that. And then Republicans have to fight from that narrative from that point forward. That's the goal.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is a, they really love the idea that the Republican Party is a racist party, that it's a white supremacist party. And they're deeply invested in that. That would explain why they're so hostile to Tim Scott. And I know you just wrote about that, as we've been writing about that. They just cannot stand the idea that there are black conservatives and Latino conservatives and Asian American conservatives. You know, we can't have this. They're invested in the idea that somehow it's a racist party. But it goes way beyond that to suggest that somehow this is comparable to segregation, to lynching, to, you know, the worst kinds of hate crimes. It's like it's just what Tim Scott said, actually, in his address, which was, they won't acknowledge there's been any progress whatsoever.
Right. And you see the same thing on with feminists as well. You know, if you talk to a feminist today, you would never know that so much progress had been made for women's rights over the last, you know, 30, 40 years. You would think that we were still stuck back in the early 1900s, mid-1900s, where, you know, they were saying a woman's place was in the kitchen, barefoot, pregnant, and all that. You would never know by listening to Democrats that we actually are a country that has made a lot of progress on the racial front, on women's rights front. So, you know, Tim Scott was right to say what he did, especially, you know, when he said that America is not a racist country. You have to be able to differentiate, which liberals don't do. You have to be able to differentiate. America is not a racist country. That doesn't mean racism doesn't exist here, but it doesn't, you know, saying that this country is racist is just not true. It's the same way with feminists who say that America is a misogynistic country. No, it's not. Yes, misogyny happens here, but we've made a lot of progress. We're not the country we were 100 years ago. We've made a lot of advancements.
Yes, and that's the fact checkers will say, oh, you know, that, again, their statements that we've made no progress is apparently acceptable or unexceptional. Now, Stacey, you're writing a lot of things on Red State about, seem to go after CNN a lot. Brian Stelter probably doesn't like you any more than he likes us.
Well, I don't know. He rarely ever responds to me, but I do know that in sometime in the last year, Oliver Darcy blocked me from Twitter, which obviously doesn't keep me from critiquing his commentary, but it is rather amusing to see, you know, him blocking me. I mean, they are supposed to be monitors, especially him, of right-wing media, yet he blocks some of the right-wing media that he's supposed to be reviewing. So it's just comical. But, you know, again, it doesn't stop me from doing what I need to do any more than it would stop you guys from doing what you needed to do as far as holding them accountable.
I'm always a little mystified when reporters block me because, yeah, I think, oh, I'm a harmless little fuzzball. I don't, you know, usually when you block someone, it's because they say like really vicious things to you.
Right.
It's the sort of thing where it's like, now you're basically trying to ruin my day. I hope I'm not tweeting that at anybody. I mean, I might, you know, I might mock that Stelter and Darcy quite a bit. But to me, blocking does seem like an extreme reaction. And when you're a journalist, when you're probably using Twitter, obviously Stelter and Darcy are using Twitter not only to get their points across, but to sort of, most journalists today are going to Twitter to see what's going on. Maybe that's part of our problem in the media, because it's not exactly like everybody's on Twitter, but they do.
I think the fact that journalists spend so much time on Twitter has been a part of why the media has lost so much trust over, you know, the last 10 years or so. And I've argued before that social media has really accelerated the death of journalism, modern journalism, you know, because you have these Insta reports that, you know, 2 hours later get updated or changed without tweets being deleted, the wrong tweets being deleted. And by that point, the false narrative has already spread across social media. And, you know, it's very frustrating for me as somebody who, you know, as much as I criticize the media, I'm actually a fan of the media. I just want them to do things the way they're supposed to do it, which is to call things down the line and don't display your biases. Report the news and allow people to form their own opinions. Don't form their own opinions for them.
Well, and I think that Twitter, obviously, one of the reasons that the news media have more of a reputation for blatant bias is because they go on Twitter and make very blatant opinions. It does become more obvious to everyone, like, oh.
They also retweet, and like in the case of Stelter and Oliver Darcy and some of the others, they retweet Media Matters and Vox.
Yep.
All the time.
Yep.
And they never I don't ever see Stelter retweeting Newsbusters.
We would not expect that.
Red State or Legal Insurrection. No, they would if you were critical of Trump. Hey, look at this conservative website. They're critical of Trump. But if they're critical of CNN, they don't want to have anything to do with you.
Yeah.
But they will, for all the talk about how they want media outlets to be honest and accountable and how they go after Fox and everything, CNN is among the worst offenders for retweeting misinformation from Aaron Rupar and others on the left who have reputations for being dishonest in their quote unquote reporting.
Yeah. I wanted to sort of wrap up by I wanted to tell you just a personal note. I got my second COVID shot yesterday. Now, I remember, I don't know how many months ago was that you and your parents got the coronavirus sort of at the same time. Is everybody doing all right?
Oh yeah, everyone is doing great. And matter of fact, when we got it all at the same time, I was worried more about my mom and dad because they're senior citizens. And my dad especially has multiple underlying health conditions that for somebody like him, COVID could have been a killer for my father. And I just remember when we got our test results thinking, oh my God, you know, what's going to happen to my family? I felt like I would be okay. But I worried about mom and dad. Fortunately, we were okay. And mom and I have both gotten both of our vaccine shots. And my dad will be getting his second one in, I think, a week or two. But yeah, it was fortunately we had in the scheme of things, we had mild cases. But I'm glad to have the vaccine. And as a matter of fact, I told my mom about a week or so ago, I'm going to be looking for places where I can go where I don't have to wear a mask because I'm really over it. I'm really, really over it. I mean, not only have I had the virus, I have had the vaccine. So I think I'm pretty inoculated against getting it or giving it. So if there's a place I can go inside here as it gets hotter in the spring and summer where I don't have to wear a mask, I'm all for it.
Yeah, I think that's where America's going. I'm glad to hear. I was actually curious as to whether you got vaccinated because you did have a case. But that's great. I am mystified by, they're so eager to pin vaccine hesitancy on the conservatives. And obviously the polls show that's where it is. But we would certainly want to say to every good conservative and Republican, especially if you care about your folks, when you're a little middle-aged, you should get your vaccine. And I don't know why that would be controversial. What seems controversial now is, we got Biden and Harris masking everywhere, masking outside. I mean, at what point does everybody get sick of that?
Well, in my opinion, and I actually spoke to, I was speaking to my mom about this yesterday because we were talking about the vaccine and the mask and whatnot. And I told her, I said, the number one person in this country contributing to vaccine hesitancy is not a conservative. It's not Tucker Carlson. It's Joe Biden. Because, I mean, in his trip to visit the Carters in Georgia is a classic example. Everybody saw the picture of the Bidens taking a picture with the Carters. They were indoors. They were maskless. They were close together, which is fine. I'm sure the Carters have been vaccinated, so they did what they were supposed to do, that you don't have to have a mask, according to the CDC, indoors if everybody's been vaccinated. That's great. But as soon as they left the house, they were wearing masks the Bidens were, and Joe Biden was double masked. So that, you know, for somebody like him, he's the president of the United States. For all the talk about how Trump contributed to a supposed climate of fear last year, about some of the things he said about the coronavirus, Joe Biden is the person in this country who probably most people would look to say, hey, you know, if the president's going outside, he's vaccinated, he's not wearing a mask, hey, I'm going to get one so I don't have to wear a mask anymore either. So I don't want to hear any talk about, you know, conservatives contributing to vaccine hesitancy by the things that they say, because the man that sits in the White House is the person who's most responsible for getting that message out. And he and Kamala Harris as well, they're both contributing to vaccine hesitancy because of how they're operating with masks outside. There's just no sense to it at this point. There's just no sense to it.
Well, I'm glad that all is well there in North Carolina. Sister told ya, look it up on Red State. See her ripping on Brian Stelter, just like Newsbusters and a lot of other writers there at Red State. Also at Legal Insurrection and the North State Journal. Stacey, thank you for coming on.
Tim, thank you for having me.
So Newsbusters, come once, twice, 24 times a day. Thanks for listening.